Hello and welcome. I'm on page 28. Oliver Kim is my name. Structure of DNA and RNA is the title of this page. And we start in the top left box again, drawing nucleotides. A nucleotide is the building block of DNA and RNA. Okay, so nucleotides are the building blocks of nucleic acids. Nucleic acids because DNA and RNA belong to the group, a chemical group of nucleic acids. Please also remember this, okay? And the idea is now is let's look only at one individual nucleotide. And one nucleotide is again made of three parts. A phosphate group, a sugar, a so-called a pentose sugar. It's a 5-carbon sugar and a base. Okay, I just need to say one thing. I once have given a little revision to my students, and the question is describe the structure of a nucleotide. And what have they done? They've given me the description of a full DNA molecule, which is not asked. Okay, the structure of a nucleotide is only one nucleotide, not the full structure of DNA and RNA. Yeah? So phosphate, sugar, and base make up one nucleotide. And now a few differences between DNA and RNA. Okay. The phosphate group is the same for DNA and RNA. The sugar, however, is different. DNA has a so-called deoxyribose sugar. That's why DNA is called DNA. And RNA has ribose sugar. That's why it's called RNA. Both of them are pentose sugars. Both of them are 5-carbon sugars, but there's a small chemical difference that you don't have to know. Okay. And then the base over here, the base, there are now 4 possibilities in DNA, and there are also 4 possibilities in RNA. However, one base is different. Okay, so down here, number 2, it says here in both DNA and RNA, there are 4 possible bases, and the adenine, cytosine, and guanine can be found in both. So it's A, C, and G. We abbreviate this with the letters. And the DNA has thymine as a 4th base, T, and uracil, U, is in RNA. Okay, that is the important distinction over here between DNA and RNA, that RNA has a U and DNA has a T. Now, if the base is a U and the sugar is a deoxyribose, then this does not exist. That's a contradiction. You cannot have the sugar of DNA and the base of RNA. Okay, this is not allowed. Okay, and just for your information. Okay. So now we go down to the structure of DNA and RNA. That's the next box. And you can now see that there are many of these nucleotides linked together into a chain. Okay, and you see that the circle is that's a phosphate and the sugar, that's always alternating. Phosphate, sugar, okay, if you go down. And this is the so-called sugar phosphate backbone. Okay, and the question is now, is this DNA or RNA? What they're showing you over here in the box in the structure of RNA and DNA, they're showing you RNA because there is a U in there, okay? That is important here, okay? So, however, this is the structure of RNA. Now, what about the structure of DNA? And that the structure of DNA you can find on the right side over here. And you, of course, can see that there's now a T in here. And you can also see that the T always bonds with an A, and the G always bonds with a C. And if you look at the very top pair, the TA pair, the very top, you can see that there are 2 lines between the T and the A. And these 2 lines that are between the T and the A boxes, these 2 lines are hydrogen bonds. You might want to label that. So between A and T, there are 2 hydrogen bonds. And between G and C, you can see that there are 3 hydrogen bonds. All of the other bonds are strong covalent bonds. Okay. You also might want to circle a nucleotide. Yeah? And be careful that you circle the phosphate, the sugar, and the base. But you see that the sugar now has 2 phosphates attached to it, one at the top and one at the bottom, right? The question, which one is it now? Okay, you have to be careful here that you circle the correct phosphate with it. And another thing that you, so in the case, in the very top one, is it's of course the phosphate. For the T, the phosphate of course sticks out towards the top. But now look on the other side, the other strand, the very right strand, you see that the sugars and the phosphates point downwards, right? So it's not, one strand, we call this the strands, one points upwards, has the phosphates, upward, and the other one, they point downwards. And this is known as a DNA being anti-parallel. The DNA is anti-parallel, so the two DNA strands, they point into opposite directions. Okay, that is also important for you to know. And it's also described here in the box structure of DNA and RNA. So, very, very briefly, a couple of summaries. How are DNA and RNA similar or different? Well, both of them, of course, are nucleic acids. They're made of nucleotides. However, DNA has a T and RNA has a U. Okay, that's one difference. DNA has deoxyribose sugar and RNA has ribose sugar. That's the second difference. And the third important difference is that DNA is made of two anti-parallel strands and RNA only of one. Okay, you see that there is a, yeah. And that is the third important difference. So it looks, DNA looks more like a ladder. And this TA and GC base pairing in DNA, this has a name. This is referred to as complementary base pairing. Complementary base pairing, okay? So it's kind of complementary means the T and A fit together and A and G and Z fit together like puzzle pieces, okay? So that is basically the chemical structure in a, very briefly, but at the very bottom, model making and the discovery of structure of DNA, a little bit of history. You see Watson and Crick over there, who in the 1950s discovered the structure of DNA. How did they do that? They had no idea how it looks like. They only had their chemical data and they made paper models. Okay, they actually tried, they cut out, based on the chemical data that they had, they cut out the parts on paper and they tried to fit it together. Okay. And this is how they figured out how, they said the only way that it really works is if we have a double helix, so a DNA which is kind of spiraled, okay? It looks like a ladder and it's also spiraled. That's why often DNA is shown in a spiral shape, okay? Because they only had this so-called the X-ray diffraction data, which is totally abstract, and they kind of tried to make sense of that. And what they figured out is if my DNA has, 20% A, they kind of figured out that it's also got 20% T, right? Now, how many G's and C's are there? Well, if you know the concentration of one base or the amount of one base, 20% A, you must know that there's 20% T because of the complementary base pairing. So this means that we still have 20 plus 20 is 40. That means we have 60% left over. And that's kind of split between G and C. So it must be 30% G and 30% C, okay? So if you know the percentage of one base, then you know also the percentage of the others because of this complementary base pairing, but it's not the case in RNA, okay? If you can have an RNA with, I don't know, only A, G, and Cs, okay? And very little U's or a lot of U's and A's, but no G's and C's, whatever, you know? In RNA, you don't have this this ratio, okay? Remember, this was once a test question. Okay. Page 29, semi-conservative replication. Okay, replication is the copying of DNA. Okay, that's a fancy name of copying, and you have to understand that DNA replication, the copying, is semi-conservative. What does this mean? That means if I have an original DNA molecule and I copy it, then I have two DNA pieces, two DNA molecules. But you cannot say that one is old, the other one is new. That is not correct. Okay, it is like this, that one strand of the DNA, of the two new DNA is old and one strand is new. Okay, so I got two pieces, one side being new and the other one being old. And for the other piece of DNA, it's also new and old. Okay, so you cannot distinguish anymore which one is new and old because both of them contain new and old DNA, you know, because of the two different strands. This is called semi-conservative because we are conserving half of the original DNA, okay? And this is because of complementary base pairing. Now, they also had so-called conservative replication. That is wrong, but they were kind of wondering, is DNA replication semi-conservative or is it conservative? We don't know, okay? So they figured it out, yeah? And conservative replication does not exist, and also dispersive replication is also where you have different parts of the molecule being old and new, but it's always different parts. That's a theoretical possibility that they were thinking about. It's also not the case. Right? Know that DNA copying is semi-conservative, but we need an experiment to prove that. Right? So that's the Mendelssohn and Stahl experiment, which is on the box on the right. Mendelssohn and Stahl, they made an experiment and they were able to show that DNA replication is semi-conservative. Now, how do you do that? Okay, they used bacteria, E. coli bacteria, and what they have done is the following. They have given, you have to understand that there is a lot of nitrogen N inside DNA, inside the DNA bases. There is a lot of N. And they, what they've done is now they've labeled the DNA, and they've, by giving the bacteria, the E. coli bacteria, they've given the they've given it food containing N15. This is heavy nitrogen, a nitrogen isotope, which is heavy. Okay, it has a neutron more, okay, and therefore it's heavier. And if you feed bacteria with heavy nitrogen for many generations, then they will use this heavy nitrogen, the N15, to make its DNA. And then they measured the using a gradient centrifuge, using a centrifuge. They then measured the DNA and they found out it was heavy, obviously, right? You give it heavy nitrogen as food, the DNA is heavy because it uses this one, yeah? And so what you see in generation zero down here is you see that the DNA can be found on at the place where there's N15. Okay, they were kind of spinning the DNA very quickly in a centrifuge, and the DNA settled down where it's supposed to be heavy, and that's what they found. And then what they've done is they've quickly changed the food, and they've given it light nitrogen food, N14 food, right? And then the bacteria were able to divide again, and after the first generation, they found out that the new DNA, which was formed, was in the middle. Yeah, and you see that's generation one. So it was not like this, that they had the old heavy DNA and then the new light DNA. That would have been an example of conservative replication. But no, they found that the new DNA was somewhere in the middle of both, right? And that's why the DNA was now can be now found between the N15 and the N14 place. And then they waited longer and longer and longer and more and more and more. And what they found out is they found out that the N14 started to become stronger with time. Okay? So it started to increase in concentration because now you didn't have any heavy N15 food anymore. So it continued using the light N14 to make new DNA. And that means all of the new DNA only contained then, of course, N14 because there was no N15 around. But the original N15 DNA stayed, okay, from the first copying, right? Because we didn't remove that. Yeah? It was not broken down, obviously. But the longer you waited, the more and more bacteria came and they all used then N14. After this change in food, okay? So that is basically the Meselson and Stahl experiment in DNA replication proved that DNA replication is semi-conservative, okay? So how is this now happening? How do you copy the DNA? Stages in DNA replication is the next topic. And there are standard level material is quite straightforward here. There are three stages, okay? Stage one, we need an enzyme. The enzyme is known as helicase. And this helicase breaks the hydrogen bonds of the original DNA molecule, exposing the bases. And it's kind of unzipping the DNA. You have to imagine it's like a zipper that unzips the DNA, right? And that's stage one. The helicase unwinds the DNA. And stage two, what happens in the second stage is that the free nucleotides that are floating around in the cell makes them. We get them from food, okay? The free nucleotides that float around in the cell are then used by DNA polymerase, and they are used to make the new DNA strand. Okay, and you can see that the free nucleotides attach to the attach in a complementary way. So if the polymerase reads, there's a T over there on the original DNA, I will insert the new free nucleotide A. And if there's a G on the original DNA, the polymerase will insert a C, okay? And then at the stage three, what we have is we have now two strands of DNA. These are the daughter DNA molecules, and they form again a double helix, okay? Essentially we have two identical pieces of DNA, each one containing an old strand and a new strand. You might want to use a highlighter actually to label the old or the original template. Template means original, okay, DNA. And those that made the new one you might use in a different highlighter, okay? So and this is possible because of complementary base pairing. Okay, complementary base pairing makes sure that at the end we then have two identical DNA strands. And you might actually want to compare this over here, right? The two DNA strands on page 29 on the bottom that are made, the very right base pairs of the top DNA molecule is AT, okay? And the bottom one, it's also AT, okay? And then the second nucleotide from the right is TA, And on the bottom, the second nucleotide from the right is also TA. And the third nucleotide from the right on the top is GC. On the bottom is also GC. So you see that the two DNA molecules are the same, okay? Because of DNA replication is sort of semi-conservative and because of complementary base pairing. We now move on. Transcription and translation, page 30. Page 30, that is the next, that's the next thing here. So DNA can be copied, okay? DNA is copied, but that is not the main point of DNA. The main point of DNA is to store the information to make proteins, okay? And on page 30, topic is transcription and translation. Transcription, you might want to mention down here, is the making of mRNA, small m, messenger RNA. And translation happens at the ribosome. That is the making of a polypeptide, the actual making of a protein. Okay. So, transcription, okay? It says here RNA polymerase and transcription. And what happens over here is the following. You see over here a drawing. And this light gray thing in the background, that's our RNA polymerase. That is an enzyme. And what this RNA polymerase does is it breaks the hydrogen bonds. It separates the two DNA strands. Kind of reminds you a little bit of the helicase, right? Of the previous drawing, which also separates the two DNA strands. But this one is, it actually works a little different, okay? So the DNA, the RNA polymerase, it kind of separates the DNA, the hydrogen bonds over here, and it will take one strand, okay, of the DNA, and it will read the original sequence of the DNA and insert a complementary nucleotide, but an RNA nucleotide, not a DNA. So what we're doing right now is we're only copying one side of the DNA, one strand of the DNA, okay, not the other one, only in this case only the bottom one, okay. And this RNA that we're making will then leave the DNA. It was not the case when we copied DNA, okay? The two new strands, the new strands stay together with the old one. Here, we're making mRNA, but it will leave the DNA. And it will not copy the whole DNA, but only a gene, only a section of it, okay? And then the DNA will go back together again, okay? And it can again be copied by again by the next RNA polymerase. So it is a little bit like this. My analogy that I'm using is the following. You've got a whole thick book, okay? That's your full DNA. But what you want to do is you only want to photocopy one page, okay? So what do? You got to open the book, okay? Like you have to open the DNA, and then you got to photocopy the book, okay? This is not the book, this one page that you want to photocopy. And you can make many photocopies from this one page, right? And you need the RNA polymerase to do that. And that's my, I don't know, my photocopy machine, okay? So to say, yeah? And then the mRNA, the messenger RNA that you were making like this, these are the individual copies. And then we close the book again, and the book is still there, and it can be, yeah, it's sitting around and waiting, okay? So do we have complementary base pairing over here in this? Yes, of course, because we need to copy the DNA based on the RNA polymerase reads the original DNA and it will insert the complementary mRNA or RNA nucleotide. Okay, so if it reads a G, it will insert a C. If it reads an A, it will insert a U because we're making mRNA. RNA has U, okay, and so on. Yeah. If it sees a T on the DNA, it will insert an A. Yeah? So that is kind of the idea. And we're kind of making this mRNA now, and this now carries the information of the DNA. DNA and RNA sequences on page 30 on the right. Okay? It will explain this a little bit in more detail over here. We here have at the top the so-called mRNA strand. It's A, U, C, G, C, U. The point is the following. Think of it like this. This mRNA strand codes for a protein, a polypeptide. It's actually more better to say polypeptide. This mRNA strand codes for a polypeptide, and therefore it makes sense. You might want to write this down next to the mRNA strand. It makes sense, okay? Now the thing is the following. The DNA that it copied it from must have the complementary sequence. And therefore, the transcribed DNA strand is known as its antisense. So the TAGCGA, that is the antisense, okay? Because it's complementary. If the mRNA makes sense, then the DNA strand that it's copied from is the antisense strand, okay? And then when we have the antisense strand, okay, over here, how does it look like in a double helix? Then we have the sense strand, which is complementary. It's ATCGCT, okay? So you see that this ATCGCT of the sense strand looks like the same sequence like with the mRNA, with the difference that the T is exchanged with a U. Okay, so in the mRNA we have AUC, GCU, and in the sense strand of the DNA we have ATC, GCT. Okay, but the one that it's copied from is the antisense strand. I know it's confusing. Okay, so the antisense strand of the DNA is transcribed, is copied to make mRNA, which hopefully makes sense. Okay, that is a little bit the thing that, yeah. So the antisense strand of the DNA is the one which is being copied, okay? So we have now our mRNA, okay? We've got our mRNA now, and what we're now going to do is this mRNA will now go to from the nucleus, if we are in a eukaryote, into the cytoplasm to the ribosomes, because the ribosomes, they make proteins. But the ribosomes, you have to understand, they're pretty dumb because they only do that what you tell them to do. And how are they supposed to know which one of this, how to make the thousands of proteins that are floating around? They make all of these kinds of proteins, but you got to tell them how to do that. Where do they get the information from? Well, from the mRNA. So we're telling them exactly how to make the protein, or the polypeptide, I should say. Okay? So, where am I gonna start? The thing is what you need. For a translation, for making of a polypeptide, you need a ribosome. The ribosome has a large and a small subunit. You, of course, need the mRNA, which we just made. And you need so-called tRNAs. These are transfer RNAs. And these transfer RNAs have, on one end of them attached, the amino acid, okay? And what I'm going to do is I'm simply going to go through the box here, translation box on page 30 on the bottom, so that you can follow along. And I'm going to start with number one on the bottom left side. It says that the messenger RNA, the mRNA, it binds to the small subunit, okay? And on the mRNA, we always organize, the mRNA is organized in so-called triplets. That means three bases, like AUG, CUG, CCU, whatever. Okay, three bases represent the code for one amino acid. Therefore, we refer to this as triplet codons on the mRNA. Okay, so like text in a book is organized into words. Okay, and the information on mRNA is organized into triplet codons. Okay, so the mRNA binds to the small subunit of the ribosome. And then you have all these tRNA, transfer RNA molecules floating around. And you see that the transfer RNA molecules on the one side have the amino acid, that's the black dot. Okay, that we want to include that. On the other side, we have the anticodon. The anticodon are, again, three bases which fit into the codons on the mRNA. They kind of fit together, because of complementary base pairing. Yeah. So that is important here. Okay, so on one hand we have the anticodon, and these anticodons should, three of these bases make this anticodon, and they should fit to the codons of the mRNA. That was number two. Number three, we're back at the ribosome, and it says there are three binding sites for the tRNA molecules. Okay, and it is like this, that a tRNA can only bind to the mRNA if the codon and the anticodon, if they fit, if they are complementary. And you can see that there are already two tRNAs inside the ribosome. You can see that the two dots, black dots, the two amino acids are now next to each other. And on the very bottom, you've got the mRNA, and you can see that there are three bases of the mRNA attached to the three bases of the tRNA, to the anticodon, okay? And it kind of fits, it's complementary base pairing. And when this happens, then the two amino acids, the two black dots, they make a peptide bond, okay? They bond together, and once this has happened, the empty tRNA, it's kind of the ribose, the tRNA is cut loose. It's removed from the amino acid and is thrown out, okay? And can then be reloaded. It's floating then again in a cell around, okay? But it's thrown out, and the next tRNA with the next ribosome, with the next amino acid, will then enter the ribosome and will again be attached. So it's always three bases on the mRNA. So for example, if your mRNA is 300 bases long, then it will code for 100 amino acids, okay? Because three bases make one amino acid. So that is translation, and because describing the whole thing is kind of difficult without actually having a film, I would highly recommend that you simply search for translation and get yourself a YouTube video, okay? But be careful that some of the this is explained in a more high level way, yeah? And this is, we're still in the standard level part over here, okay? So, but understand, we need tRNAs, we need the amino acids connected to them, we need a large and a small subunit of the ribosome, we need mRNA. The mRNA has the codons, the tRNA has the anticodons, and only those that fit together will actually enter the ribosome and carry along the correct amino acid. The reason is because for every codon we have specific amino acids, and this is explained on page 31, the genetic code. Okay, so we're on page 31 using the genetic code, and there is this table, and you have to, it's relatively easy, but you have to know how to read this. Okay, let's say the following. Let's say that we have on the mRNA the codon AUG, and we would like to know what amino acid does AUG code for. Okay, and so let's read it off. Okay, so at the very left, we have we look for A. It says your first base of codon on the 5' end of the mRNA. So you go to the A, all the way down to A. And in the A row, we have isoleucine, methionine start, okay? Or methionine start. And but it was AUG, so we look for the U, okay? The U is at the very top. Second base of codon of messenger RNA, that's the U at the top. And then we're in this box here, in the first box, which contains isoleucine, methionine, or start. But what about the G? G, AUG, where do I find the G? The G I can find on the very far right. Okay, on the very far right, in this row, I'm looking for G, U-C-A-G. G, G is the fourth one here, okay, in this row, and it's methionine start. So AUG stands for methionine, or the start codon. It's always the first amino acid which is inserted. It's always methionine. It's the start codon. Or what about UUU? What does UUU code for? Okay, you go on the very right. You left, you go for the U. At the very top, you find the U. And then again, you find U over there. And it's phenylalanine. Yeah, it's UUU. And what you can see is that there are sometimes different codons will give you the same amino acid. So for example, UUU will give you phenylalanine, and also UUC will give you phenylalanine, okay? That is possible. This has a name. The genetic code is called degenerate. And degenerate means that multiple codons can code for the same amino acid. For your information, you will also see that there are three stop codons, UAA and UAG, and also UGA. These are the stop codons, and for these there are no amino acids because if the ribosome encounters a stop codon, it will stop making the protein. Okay, so that is there. So there is no tRNA for that, right? So that is genetic code. Okay, and if you are given a genetic code, then you can read it off. And there is an example. It says here on the right. For example, the sequence CACAGAUGGGUC codes for histidine, arginine, tryptophan, and valine. Okay, CAC you can actually try. To find CAC, you divide this up into triplets, and then you read it off using the table. So, next box, production of human insulin in bacteria. This was one of the first things which was done by genetic engineering. The 51 amino acids in human insulin. So it's actually quite a small protein, okay? You even have a formula down there. and it is a chain of it's a chain of amino acids. And the thing is, the following what they've done is they've taken human insulin DNA and incorporated it into E. coli bacteria, and the E. coli bacteria now started to make human insulin. That is kind of cool. In other words, it means that the bacteria understand this genetic code. So in other words, the genetic code in all living things is the same. So this is called the universality of the genetic code. In other words, AUG codes for methionine in all living things. UUU codes for phenylalanine in all living things, and so on. Okay? And this is that the language, so to say, which is spoken by different organisms is the same. Okay? In other words. Yeah? And this refers to the universality of the genetic code. So the genetic code is universal, and it is degenerate. Degenerate meaning that multiple amino acids, several triplets can code for the same amino acid. And these two things are also evidences for evolution, or that all of the, or let's say rather the relatedness of all life. Okay, the relatedness of all life, because it doesn't have to be like this. I mean, theoretically, it's possible for the genetic code to be different between different organisms, but it's not. Okay. So this means there must have been a common ancestor here. Okay. So page 31 on the bottom. Okay, that's a PCR, polymerase chain reaction. Okay, very briefly. This is a very short thing. PCR, or polymerase chain reaction, is the following: is the copying is DNA replication in vitro. In vitro means inside a test tube. So a PCR, if they ask you, what is it? What is PCR? Well, it's the exponential copying of DNA in vitro. And what do you need? If you want to copy DNA inside a test tube, you need original DNA that you want to copy. You need DNA nucleotides. These are the building blocks for the new DNA, of course. You got to make new DNA, so you need the building blocks. And you need so-called a polymerase, and they call it DNA polymerase, and they call it TAC. Polymerase. TAC comes from Thermus aquaticus. It's the name of a bacterium that they got it from, right? And what we have to do is the following. We want to copy the DNA, and you also need so-called RNA primers. I think this is and the RNA primers, they basically tell the polymerase which parts to copy. Okay, you have a long DNA, but which sections do you want to copy? You got to add some RNA primers. It's also required. Okay, so what do you do? Very briefly, is you have to heat up the DNA in a machine, and this heating up will separate the complementary bases. It will break apart the bases, and then the polymerase can start copying. Okay, and because the polymerase is temperature, normally the polymerase, isn't being an enzyme, is temperature sensitive, as I told you, because of denaturing, they use the TAC polymerase, and this is a very temperature stable enzyme. Okay, that's simply the thing that you should know. They're using a very temperature stable enzyme. And for your information, why PCR is so important, that is the method that is also used in forensics. If you are doing DNA fingerprinting and if you want to identify people, for example, then PCR is used a lot. It's a very important molecular biological technique for which the guy who discovered it or invented it got the Nobel Prize in the 1980s. Okay, and now this is a standard procedure in molecular biology, and it's very, very practical, very important. Okay. So the detailed procedure is described in topic 3. It just mentions over here. Okay. So this was basically a quick run through, and I'm finished now. No, I'm not finished with this topic. The next topic would be cell respiration and photosynthesis, but I'm going to make a separate audio file of that. I wish you a nice day. Bye.